And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whoso will not come up of all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. And if the family of Egypt go not up and come not, that have no rain, there shall be the plague wherewith the Lord will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And that day shall there be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord, and the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. And all they that sacrifice shall come and take of them and seethe therein. And in that day there shall be no more the Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. Parties. I mean, who doesn't like parties? Who doesn't like a party on their birthday? Who doesn't like a party when they graduate? Who doesn't like a party on a holiday? Now, some of you might be thinking, and that's really not me. I could do without all of this parties. I'm not a party person. And yet, we do like celebrations in one form or another. You see, I understand the anti-party sentiment. I'm not a party person myself. And some of us hear the word party and cringe. Maybe we're at an age where we don't want to be reminded by a party of how old we're getting. And sometimes a graduation is not a time for celebration because we don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes we don't want holidays to be celebrated. We just want to do something else. And all of our reasons to party have something missing, some element that would tend to ruin our celebration. And I put it to you that even the feast in the Old Testament have this kind of element of anticipation rather than fulfillment. You know, it's like when you graduate from high school and you have a party, and yet, what are you celebrating if you know you're going to college? I mean, you're not celebrating that you're out of school. You're just trading one school, one education, for another. And for the people in Zechariah's days, the feasts of the Lord were kind of like that. Each remembered the work of God in the past, but it also pointed to the necessity of a greater work, a greater harvest, a greater atonement, a bigger Passover. And this passage deals with the Feast of Tabernacles, a feast that remembered the past, remembered Israel dwelling in tents, but pointed forward to something even greater. The tabernacles reminded Israel of the wilderness wanderings and of the patriarchs. And now, as they returned to exile, they might have felt like they were back in those tents. They may have felt like they were back in the patriarchs, living in a land that wasn't really theirs. If you remember, when Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were in the land, this was the land that they were given, and yet the land was not theirs. They were dwelling in tents. They were nomads. Then the tents reminded Israel, even when they were in the land, of God's faithfulness to them while they were in Egypt. And yet, as they are there in the exile, after the exile, they're back in the land, and yet it's not their land. They're remembering God bringing them into the land, but that exile had kind of spoiled it. We remember that in Zechariah, we've already had this event where the people come to Zechariah and ask, do we need to still celebrate some of these things? And the things that they were celebrating were commemorations of the exile, commemorations of the fall of Jerusalem. And maybe as Zechariah is writing this, there's a question in the mind of the exiles having returned. Why are we celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles? Why are we celebrating this thing that remembers the patriarchs, that remembers that God was faithful to us to bring us into this land, that we don't have to dwell in tents anymore, that we're in the land, woohoo! Yeah, we're in the land, but the land's not really ours anymore. Yeah, we might not be living in tents anymore. We might have houses that we're living in. But there's still something wrong. There's still something that's spoiling our celebration. Instead of like it was before the exile, when we were in the land and it was ours. We're in the land. We're in houses. We're not in tents anymore. But there's an element wrong. Was this going to be the way it was for the foreseeable future? Is this going to be all that we look forward to, is living in this land that's not ours again? In the final passage, in the prophecy of Zechariah, the Lord continues his picture of the last days, the fulfillment of all of his promises, with another frame of reference. We looked at this last week. It's how the frame of reference was the temple and Jerusalem, and how Jerusalem is expanded beyond its current borders, beyond its current meaning. And the same thing is true about the Feast of Tabernacles. The Lord uses this feast as a foundation for the promise of the future. In this passage, we begin with the expansion of the feast. We see how it leads, the absence from this feast leads to famine. And the last section, though the feast is not mentioned, it presents a fullness of the promise. We look at this passage under the headings of the blessings of God, the judgment of God, and the holiness of God. The blessings of God, the judgment of God, and the holiness of God. The prophecy turns from Jerusalem to the feast, to the blessings that God gives them, and the remembrance of those blessings in the Feast of Tabernacles. We like the story of the armies surrounding Jerusalem that were rotting and plundered. But from them we turn to the rest of the Gentiles who now come to Jerusalem in order to worship. Notice who the focus of this prophecy is. Look at verse 16. "And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts." This is follows a lot of the things that have already been seen in this chapter. In chapter 1, beginning of this chapter, in verses 1 and 2, we saw the armies coming against Jerusalem and the way in which they plundered them and the horrors there. And then in the verses immediately preceding verse 16, verse 12 through verse 15, we see the plague that the Lord brings upon those who would besiege Jerusalem. And the plague that made their eyes and their tongues to rot, a kind of gruesome vision, and a plague that expands through all of their weapons of war, all of their beasts of burden. It's not Israel, but the nations who camped against Jerusalem who are brought year by year to Jerusalem to worship. And we have to ask the question, how would this be of an encouragement to the people of Israel? Would they not have preferred if all their foes fell through the plague? Wouldn't they have probably preferred to see everyone who came against Jerusalem just utterly destroyed? Well, perhaps. But the power of the Lord of hosts is not merely revealed in the destruction of people, but in their conversion. There is an element of victory in the conversion of the Gentiles. They join Israel in worshiping the Lord of hosts. They join with Israel in this worship. It's not Israel that's the focus here. It's all of the other nations, all the Gentile nations, those who used to be their enemies are now their allies. And this says something to us in our present, does it not? Because we are as well Gentiles who have been engrafted into the people of God. This verse is about us. We are those who used to be against Jerusalem. For when we were aliens and strangers, we had no part of the covenant of grace. Through Christ, we are made worshipers of the one true God. We are the living fulfillment of this verse. We are those who God has grafted in through faith in Jesus Christ. And notice what we are to worship. We are brought up year by year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts. And we've seen this word, this phrase, the Lord of hosts, again and again throughout Zechariah. It's this word of assurance to this exiled people that this is the Lord of armies, the Lord that protects them, the Lord that preserves them, the one God that is to be worshipped. He is called the King, reminding us of the previous passage in verse 9, the Lord shall be King over all the earth. This is about His rule over all things. And yet, even the Gentiles are brought up year by year to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles is an interesting feast. If you remember that every year, every male Israelite was to go to Jerusalem for three times for these feasts, the Feast of Passover, the Feast of Pentecost, and the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles was an interesting feast because it worked on a number of layers. It worked on the layer of the patriarchs living in the land, living in Canaan, in tents. But that was kind of the broad, forgettable, or way back idea. The more immediate context of the Feast of Tabernacles was Israel living in the wilderness in tents. It was a commemoration that worked on a number of levels. It remembered that God had preserved His people in the wilderness. While they were living in tents, they were dependent upon God for food and water, and God was faithful. In my mind, which is a little twisted, I almost think that there was a kind of embarrassment to the whole thing, because they should have been reminded also about how they kept complaining to God about the fact that they weren't satisfied with His food and water during the 40 years of wilderness wandering. But the activity, the feast, was to remind them of God's faithfulness to that. It was also to remind them that they didn't have to live in tents anymore, except for that one week where they had to because of the feast. They lived in houses, houses they didn't build. They feasted on fields that they didn't plant. All of these things that they enjoyed because of what God had done for them. The God who was King. And it's curious that this worship of God yearly for the Gentiles is focused on the Feast of Tabernacles. Why is Tabernacles mentioned here? Why is it that the Gentiles are to worship this very specific feast that had something very specific to say about the land? There's an element of anticipation, though, to this, especially for those who had returned from exile, to those who considered the prophecies of old and asked the question, has God forgotten His promises? Yes, we are celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, but there's something missing. It's not like it used to be. In the return, may not Israel have felt like they were back in the tents of anticipation, back in tents looking forward to something. And so they are. The Feast of Tabernacles, even for Israel in the land, anticipating something greater, a larger fulfillment. Now, before you all accuse me of reading into the Feast of Tabernacles, I want to take us to Hebrews chapter 11. In Hebrews chapter 11, they talk about this faith of those who are patriarchs. In Hebrews chapter 11, in verses 9 and 10, we read, by faith he, that is Abraham, sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundation, whose builder and maker is God. And so the author of Hebrews, when he sees Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob living in tents, he says they are looking for a city. He's looking for a city, and it's interesting that, again, this all focuses on the city of Jerusalem. But it's not Jerusalem in the Middle East. It's not Jerusalem of the exiles. It's not that physical location that they were looking in, that were trusting in, that they were anticipating. Because the author of Hebrews says that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were looking for a city that was bigger than Jerusalem in the Middle East. They were looking for a city that was better than that city that they knew of, that the exiles in Zechariah's day were living in. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were looking for a city whose builder and maker is God. The author of Hebrews continues in verses 13 through 15, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embrace them and confess that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, in heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. We have a kind of, and the author of Hebrews has kind of conflated two ideas, city and country. Did you notice that? Because he doesn't want that location. He doesn't want that geography to be limited. Even as we look at Revelation and you see this giant city that's a cube coming down out of heaven that is, you know, beyond big in terms of our understanding, that for the day would have completely covered the entirety of the known world. Because what he is saying is that the country is limitless. The country is the city of God, the place where God dwells with his people. Peter applies this idea of us being strangers and pilgrims in the land to Christians in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 11. We are on our way to a heavenly rest that remains for us, Hebrews 4, verses 1 through 12, 11. And we identify with the people living in Zechariah's day because they lived between the times. They lived between the times of the return from exile and the coming of Jesus. We live between the times as well because we live between the first coming of Jesus and the second coming of Jesus. We live in an anticipation of a blessing yet to be received. Our feasts remind us of our pilgrim life, that we have received God's blessings, that we have experienced a fullness of God's blessings better than that which those in Zechariah's days understood. That we see the fulfillment of everything they anticipated, and yet we still live in anticipation. As they lived in tents, and they were saying, by living in tents, there is a better heavenly country coming. There is a better heavenly city to come. So we as well don't live in tents, but we understand what it is to be pilgrims. To understand the blessings of God for us have been received, and we are anticipating a greater reception. Not only see the blessings of God, but we also see the judgment of God. While the vision of the New Jerusalem points to the last day, there remains an already and not yet aspect to the prophecy. The prophetic utterance rarely stick with a certain chronology, but seem to move through time, even as we think of different planes of fulfillment. That's one of the reasons that these prophecies often become very confusing, because we want them to be nice and chronological for us. We want them to follow this happens, then that happens, then that happens. And the prophecies don't always do that. They don't cooperate with our understanding of chronology. God's giving us a vision. That's what I think when Derek Thomas says of Revelation, that it's like a comic book with big colors and bright things. What he's partly getting at is that you can't squeeze these prophecies into our own understanding. We cannot impose our understanding upon them. And so even as you have this vision of God completely bringing those who are his enemies either into destruction or into relationship with him, there's a kind of middle part here. It's not as if there's a point to the second coming of Jesus. There's a point of the complete fulfillment of all things. And we'll get to the ultimate fulfillment of all things at the end. But here we have this kind of tension between the times as we look at the judgment of God. And here we see it in terms of famine, a present age reality rather than an age to come. There's an imperfection here that is revealed in this famine. But it's interesting as you look at these verses how the Lord deals with the nations in general in distinction from Egypt. Notice the condemnation begins with general judgment. Look at verse 17. And it shall be that whoso will not come up of all the families of the earth unto Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, even upon them shall be no rain. Here we have this idea, the repetition of verse 16. All the nations of the earth are required to appear before the Lord in Jerusalem to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. There have been some that have asserted that this is a part of the millennial reign of Christ, and yet that's a very iffy and not all to be accepted understanding of this. This is probably better to be understood as a present reality, as a time between times. This is about us in our day, which was future for Israel in Zechariah's day, but is very present for us. That there is a necessity of worship. Notice what it says here, that those who will not come up of all the families of the earth into Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts. We've seen that language before. It's a copy of the language in verse 16. The address of the King, the ruler of all, the Lord of hosts, the one who is able to defeat his enemies. And that power that we have seen associated with the Lord of hosts, the power and authority we have seen in the King, to those who rebel against him, there is judgment. A judgment of lack of rain. That lack of rain brings to mind the punishment of Israel in the days of Elijah, with the sins of Ahab and Jezebel, the sins of worshiping Baal and Ashtaroth. You might be out thinking, and possibly rightly so, it seems a little harsh that someone who misses a year of going up to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles is given the judgment that is associated with this idol worship and the gross idol worship of Ahab and Jezebel. If Ahab, it was said that he was one of the worst of ever of Israel's kings. And yet the departure from the worship of the Lord is by default idolatry. When you don't worship God, you will worship something else. You are made to worship God, and if you take him out, then something will fill the void of God in a human heart. We also see the unity here between the blessing of the Lord and his presence with his people. If you remember, there's something else about tents that we remember from, of course, Exodus chapter 33, because you know I have to squeeze that into almost every sermon ever. Because there, the tent of meeting, as you look at the tabernacles, is reminding them of the wilderness wanderings. It's reminding them also of the presence of the Lord with them. You remember Exodus chapter 17 and the provision of water from the rock. Is God with us or not? And here, water is associated again with the presence of the Lord. And those who absent themselves from the presence of the Lord suffer the consequence of no rain, no water. We see this as the judgment upon the nations, but then Egypt is singled out in verse 18. And if the family of Egypt go not up and come not, that have no rain, there shall be plague, wherewith the Lord will smite the heathen that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Verse 18 is probably, I don't know how it reads in your version, but you're probably very confused about what in the world verse 18 is all about. And you are probably in good company, because all the commentators really struggle with verse 18 because the grammar makes no sense at all. It's as if something has been left out. And the word that has been left out is the word rain. And there's been something added. And the word that's been added is the word plague. Now, we can understand why the word plague would be added to a verse about Egypt in particular. It takes our mind back, does it not, to the 10 plagues on Egypt that brought the Exodus about. But why is rain left out? Why is it that instead of, in verse 17, it's very easy to understand what the consequence for all the other nations is for not showing up to the Feast of Tabernacles is. There is no rain. Well, I suggest to you that with the idea of plague being in mind and the way in which we see the plagues upon Egypt being related and the way in which Egyptian agriculture worked, Egyptian agriculture didn't really depend to that much on rain as much as it did on the river. And perhaps the reason that rain is not mentioned is that the plague that is going to come upon Egypt is going to have to do with the Nile. That because you look in verse 19, This shall be the punishment on Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that come not up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. You can envision that a plague upon Egypt with no rain doesn't make matter as much as a plague upon Egypt that makes the Nile not work. That it's the same agricultural judgment of God. That the judgment is brought upon the fruitfulness of the land. Whether it be through the Nile or whether it be through rain, there is a unity of the judgment that is brought upon all the people. Egypt's probably mentioned also as well as being those, if you remember, you would wonder, why would Egypt be celebrating a festival that was about them, people escaping from Egypt? And yet all the people, even those who used to be the captors of God's people, the captors of Israel, are included in this feast, included in the worship of God. And yet they, in particular, are not excluded. They're not exempt from the judgment that comes. By this prophecy, the Lord, through Zechariah, puts the Gentiles to two options. All the people that surrounded Jerusalem, all the people that were not Israel, they have a choice of feast or famine, celebration or scarcity. And when I say that, it's not as if that Israel is somehow given an escape clause out of this. Because the very mention of no rain reminds Israel that they aren't exempt from this either. The very mention of that shadow of Elijah reminds them that when they left, when they did not worship the Lord, they experienced the very same thing. And it is not as if the prophet suggests a kind of prosperity gospel. As if when you worship God, you get the rain, and when you don't worship God, you don't get the rain. As if when you worship God, everything is perfect, and when you don't worship God, everything is horrible. Instead, this is a new understanding of the condition that God's people find themselves in. Remember, this is written to a people who had returned from exile to Jerusalem, a people who were asking whether or not they should still observe these memorials to the overthrow of Jerusalem, a people who were struggling with the goodness of God in their midst. And in this promise, they are encouraged to keep the Feast of Tabernacle as a celebration of the richness they had received from the Lord. You see, in this curse, in this judgment of God, the people of God are being reminded of His blessing. The people of God are being reminded of His goodness to them. The people of God are being reminded of what it is that they have received from the Lord, not just of their salvation, but daily benefits that they have from Him. We have a problem in our modern day church, I think, where we forget too often to be thankful. We forget too often to give thanks unto the Lord, not just for our salvation, but for every other thing that He has blessed us with. We forget to come before the Lord with thanksgiving and say to Him, we may be still living in tents, we may still be pilgrims and strangers in a land, we may still be anticipating a redemption yet to come, but You have been faithful to us in the past. You have brought us out of bondage into freedom, and You are daily bestowing upon us Your goodness. You see, the judgment of God reminds us of the blessings of God. And finally, I wanted to see the holiness of God. So here we are at the very last vision of the book of Zechariah, a book of visions, a book of judgments, a book of encouragements, and a book of warnings, a book to encourage people and provoke them to a larger vision of the glory of God. And that larger vision can't get much bigger than the final vision. A vision of horses and houses, but glorious for all that. A vision of horses and tools or pots. And it begins with a very curious statement. Look at verse 20. In that day shall there be upon the bells of the horses holiness unto the Lord. And the pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bulls before the altar. You would almost have thought that the first part of verse 20 was close to blasphemy, at least sacrilegious. But we probably, over the years, have lost what makes it so astonishing. Because the word, the phrase, holiness to the Lord, was really inscribed in one location. It was upon the headpiece that the high priest wore. Because of his unique office, he and he alone had holiness to the Lord written on the top of his headpiece. That was a mark, a special mark that represented his separation from everything else. And now that name, that phrase, is going to be inscribed on the bells that adorn horses. Let that sink in on you, that this kind of strange activity, to have such a sacred statement attached to horses, would strike one as at least sacrilege, if not utter blasphemy. A horse as high priest, a horse adorned with a mark of holiness. And yet, this is no blasphemy. This is from the Lord himself. It is a marvelous promise that in that day, the last day, in the day of the Lord, even the horses will be considered holy to the Lord. Even the horses will be considered sanctified to the Most High. It goes on, the pots of the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yea, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness unto the Lord of hosts. Every pot, by extension, every single thing, shall be like the bowls, the pots that are used in the temple. These vessels that were used in worship. The vision here is of holiness expanded, of God's presence and God's sanctifying work applied to all. It is the same image that appears in Revelation 21, where this cube of Jerusalem comes down from heaven, a cube that in its dimensions reflects the Holy of Holies. In Revelation, it's not just the temple, it's not just a city, but the Holy of Holies, the very presence of God that is filling all the earth, that is filling everything. Verse 21, and all that sacrifice shall come and take of them and seethe therein. The statement there, if you remember in the operation of the temple, it was the priest's gift to take of the sacrifice, the holy thing, and it would be part of their meal, it'd be part of their food, it's part of their payment. And it is as if the entire city now is a city of priests. That's the vision that Zechariah gives to these people in exile. He is saying to them, yes, I understand, you're building this temple, and it doesn't look like it was in the past. You're living in a city without walls. You're asking, has the Lord not been faithful to his promise? But I am telling you that there will come a day where everything in Jerusalem is going to be temple, where everything in this city is going to be holy to the Lord, where every single one of you is going to be a priest. And that vision that Zechariah gives them is to encourage them, but it is pushed further in the New Testament. Because it's not just the city of Israel, it's not just the city of Jerusalem that is holy. It is the new Jerusalem, the new reality, the new heavens and the new earth, where we will be a kingdom of priests, as it is said in Revelation. But notice at the final statement, and there shall in that day there shall be no more Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. An interesting statement in this incredible book on. And it suffers from translation because the word Canaanite that appears here can refer to the inhabitants of the land before Israel invaded, or it could refer to a simple traitor. And so some translations say that the traitor will not be in the house of the Lord of hosts. But that's a real rather curious thing, and you can understand why that may have been a preferred translation to those who are trying to connect it with the New Testament, especially when you think of Jesus in the temple casting out the merchants. No traitor in the house of the Lord of hosts. And yet, within the context of Egypt and plague and the battles around Jerusalem, the context of holiness, the idea of haram, that judgment, that complete and utter destruction that was to be done to all the Canaanites and the inhabitants of the land. Perhaps Canaanite is to be understood. The absence of the Canaanite demonstrates that the last remnants of rebellion against God have been removed. That in the Lord's house, which probably now is to be envisioned as being the entire city, everywhere where holiness to the Lord is seen, that which was rebelled against Israel, that which has rebelled against God, that which has lifted up its heel against the Lord of hosts, has been removed forever. All that remains is God's people living in peace. In the end of Zechariah, there is a question. Are you a part of the Canaanites who will be removed? Are you a part of Israel? Are you a part of that group of people who rebel against God? Or are you those who have been united to God? You see, there's no exemption. There's no neither option. You're either one or another. You're either a friend of God or you're a rebel against God. We are all born rebels against God. But God has made a way through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ to make those of us who are born rebels, who are born sinners, who sinned by birth and choice, to be in His family, to be part of the family of God, to be able to dwell in the house of the Lord, to be able to live in His holiness, to have imprinted upon our forehead, holy unto the Lord. Not because we are holy, but because of the righteousness that He has accomplished for us. Have you received Jesus? Brothers and sisters, we look with anticipation for the day when all of this is going to be ours. We look for the day when we will be able to stand before God and have imprinted on our forehead, holy unto the Lord. This holiness has a number of levels upon which it operates. We already have holy unto the Lord imprinted upon us because we are justified. We have been declared righteous in God's sight. We have holy unto the Lord imprinted upon our foreheads because we endeavor every day to live out who we are, what He has made us. And yet we look for the day when all that remains in us is holy. We look to the day when there will be no more impurity in the house of the Lord. Paul writes to us and tells us that know ye not, you are the temple of the Lord. And for some of us, we think, well, that's rather unfortunate. Because we look in ourselves and do not find purity and holiness. And yet as we daily experience the work of the Holy Spirit purifying us, we look forward to the day when nothing will remain in us but that which is holy. When we will be perfected in holiness. And day by day, we endeavor to make that future reality a part of our present. Gracious Lord, give unto us of your grace that we might live our lives in holiness before you. Forgive us for our sins. Forgive us for our lack of thanksgiving. Forgive us when we have not reflected on the blessings that you have poured out upon us. And ever enable us to live holy unto you. For we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.